I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, Gia Tolentino on her debut essay collection, Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. Gia Tolentino is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Raised in Texas, she studied at the University of Virginia before serving in Kyrgyzstan in the Peace Corps and receiving her MFA in fiction from the University of Michigan. She was a contributing editor at The Hairpin and the deputy editor at Jezebel, and her work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Grantland and Pitchfork, and Gia's debut book, Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion, we're going to talk about today. Gia, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you for having me on.
I want to talk about that subtitle first of all. This collection of essays, how does it reflect the theme of self-delusion?
Well, I want to say, first of all, that I hate subtitles. I think they're super cheesy. And I wouldn't have had one if I apparently didn't need to show that it wasn't a novel. Like, I think subtitles and epigraphs are cheesy as hell. So subtitle is not my choice. I made one of my friends think of it at the bar 15 minutes before, like, it was due. Like, the cover was, like, going to print. I was just like, ugh. And she is a brilliant writer and a former copywriter. And she was like, what if we do reflections? And I was like, okay, I guess that's okay. I think that the book is about situations in culture and in my own life that seem just conducive to self-delusion. And the first essay in it, I mean, like, it's the book also comes out of a type of thing that I have been thinking about for a long time, which is that I think that, you know, as our world is increasingly structured around the internet and participation in the internet is, you know, it's essentially like your selfhood is monetized on the internet even if you don't monetize it yourself, right? Like,
it's monetized by somebody else.
It's monetized by someone else. Like, selfhood is the economic engine of the internet, right? And I think all of the social networks on the internet are structured in such a way that they make personal identity basically seem like the center of the universe. And I think under those conditions, knowing yourself becomes an impossibility and also a requirement, you know, an incentive, and like these two conflicting things. And I think that contradiction is interesting, especially because it's inescapable, because it's built into the internet. So the idea of on the internet, you know, yeah, you were asked to sort of triangulate yourself constantly and kind of entrench some consistent idea of yourself. And at the same time, in doing that, it seems almost impossible to get a clear shot of who you actually are. And so the book is about that and eight other situations like that.
And I want to talk about that first essay, which is about, I mean, you're, you know, what they call an internet native.
Yeah. Sort of, I came of age when the internet did.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's ruined me.
And there's a point where the internet changes, and it's, you know, generally roughly around the introduction of social media, which is the thing that sort of brings in this idea of curating a self-image for yourself.
I actually think it's around the monetized social media, right? Mm. Like, I think it's the monetization that's the real problem. But yeah.
There's another insight you have into this whole idea of creating that persona, because I don't really want to go into too much detail on this, but you starred in a sort of pre-social media reality show in which, I guess, a sort of personality was created for you by somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's what they thought they were doing.
Yeah.
I mean, If you watch the show, they didn't actually create a personality for me. Like, I appear on the show shockingly similar to probably how I appear talking to you right now. They did think that they were casting me as one type, which is this type. Like, they thought I interviewed everyone I was on the show with, and I interviewed the producer. This was a show I filmed in 2004 when I was a senior in high school. And I asked her, I was like, why did you cast me? Because I was never sure exactly what role I played. Also, because I had never seen it, because I didn't want to, you know, I was like, I got to do it, but I don't have to watch it. And then I watched it to write this essay. But she said that they had cast me as this sort of like type A, you know, this type A sort of bossy, like smart girl. And that's not actually my personality. It's something that can, like, it's maybe an aspect of it in certain contexts, but that's not actually how I am. And on the show, I don't come off the way that she thought I was going to. The relationship of the reality TV thing to the internet is more, I've never felt that I am constructing a different self for the internet, and I never felt like I was constructing a different self for reality TV. That's kind of what scares me. Like, I've taken really naturally to these mechanisms without seemingly changing myself, although I know they have changed me in some way. Like, these structures of, you know, nonstop self-surveillance and self-broadcasting do, they must inevitably change you. But when I was on that show, I didn't think it was strange to be monitored all the time and to be sort of thinking about, or to just be in this structure where everything was caught on camera. And I think I realized when I watched the whole show last year, I was like, oh, that's why you're so comfortable on the internet, because you just, you take to this horrible situation like a duck to water.
I want to talk about how that idea of creating a self-image for yourself has sort of bled into, well, I hesitate to call it real life, because the internet obviously is real life nowadays. Yeah. But in your chapter on optimization of yourself, and obviously this is something that, you know, affects women in the world a lot more.
Yeah.
But I want to talk about this idea of you can be the best you can possibly be.
Yeah. So,
all the time.
So the optimization essay is another, in terms of how it gives us an idea of the self that is not necessarily organic to how the self actually feels, and it's not necessarily true. It's like, I think that I understood since I was little that, you know, the first time I picked up a magazine for teen girls, let's say, I think I understood that what it meant to be a woman to the world was to be in a body and be in a personality that should continuously be improved as to be maximally appealing. And that idea has shaped me in ways that I can't even see because they're so deep in me. And I don't necessarily, like with all of these things, I don't even, it's a fact and it's not necessarily a judgment, right? Like, I don't think, I think that having to understand that I needed to be careful of other people's feelings and understand that I, you know, needed to make them feel comfortable around me. I don't think that's necessarily that part I'm grateful for, but there's a punitive part to it. And specifically when I'm writing about the optimization question, right, it's this idea that we can just make everything more perfect and more efficient and more beautiful. And I think as, you know, we enter, or as we are living deep within this stage of capitalism, efficiency has become, it's gone from something that could be good to something that is essentially mandatory. And, you know, this idea of self-improvement, it was before, it was supererogatory. It was not, it was something that, you know, could be beneficial. And now it's basically compulsory to continue to survive. And it's like this no matter where you are. And like, or, you know, it's obviously not like this for every single person in the world, but I do think that this paradigm affects people just all the way up and down the income spectrum. But specifically, yeah, I think that the idea that the self should be continually improving and that it can, I think it affects women in a particular way, like located in the body, right? There's this idea that somehow, you know, women should forever look like they're 27 until they're 60, you know, just these impossible ideas of, yeah. And then I write about like athleisure as the, like, that was my real entry point. I worked upstairs from a Lululemon flagship store in New York, and I was just like walking by it, and I was like, this is the uniform for treating the body like a market asset. Like, it's like, it's something that has to improve its performance on the market over time.
I've gone through my life oblivious to a lot of this stuff. You talk about a thing, an exercise routine, bar. Is it bar, or are we supposed to pronounce it different?
Bar, yeah, 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 yeah.
I don't know, which I'd never heard of. And of course, then I read the book, and I was in, as I've just mentioned to you before we started, I was in the US last week, and
yeah,
we were in Harvard Square. And
you saw
within
it.
5 minutes, I saw three different,
I know,
places.
It is. It's sneakily everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, I see people in the clothes that you describe as athleisure, all the time, but I'd never really sort of noticed it. And then again, I saw a Lululemon at a mall that we were at.
Yeah, you know, right. It's really, it's almost like the air that women breathe, you know, and it does, it truly, I mean, I think men have, there's another version for men, right? Like, I think there's the, like the 4-hour work week, the sort of the, you know, life hacky sort of culture for men is a version of this. Mm-hmm. But for women, it's a really specific thing where, like, I really do feel in this, in a bar class, which basically it splits up your body into parts and makes you just improve one over and over over 15 minutes at a time. You really do feel the assetization, the sort of financialization of your body, because the clothes are expensive, the glasses are expensive. It's like, I think there are a lot of optimization industries. Like, I think fast casual food chains, like healthy food chains, mm-hmm. are like this. It's like, these are adaptive mechanisms for late capitalism. They're not actually food or clothes, you know? And it's like, you have to make a lot of money to be able to afford to do these things that keep you healthy enough to make as much money as you need to, you know, and it's just this perpetually escalating cycle.
And this is, of course, I mean, for, you know, in terms of women's bodies, same as it ever was, really.
Yeah.
But this, again, like almost everything that women do now, this is empowering.
Right. So the difference, what I find really pernicious is like, right, in the 50s, you would be told to look more beautiful and be more appealing and all of this. And it would be like, do it for your husband, do it so you can get a husband. And now it's like, do it for you. Do it because, you know, like you're a feminist, you know, like you're a badass lady. And that is something that has always really grinded my gears.
A theme that emerges throughout all of the essays that I just want to talk about more generally is just the sort of institutionalized misogyny and obviously racism as well. I want to talk about how that manifests itself. Particularly, there's an essay, The Cult of the Difficult Woman, which is, again, a sort of, women are encouraged to do this, to optimize themselves, to achieve, to monetize themselves. When they do, they just get knocked down again in the same old way.
Yeah. Well, I think so. One of the things that I think a structure of male power has loved to do with women is to designate a set of traits that comprise an ideal woman, right? And for a long time, those traits are extremely predictable. Like the idea that there would be an ideal woman was kind of a precondition. And, you know, that ideal woman is like very, very beautiful, very sort of domestic, very, you know, like set, like would just be kind of put other people's needs above hers, you know. And I think that essay, The Cult of the Difficult Woman, is about how I think there are a lot of things that the most mainstream version of feminism has just taken male demands and rebranded them, you know, like the idea that women should be super, super, super beautiful. Now it's still true, but it's like a feminist concern that all women are beautiful and that, and it's just like, what I want is a world where beauty matters less, right? And the same is true, like where there was once this ideal of a woman, which is, of course, this self-evidently dangerous thing because, you know, you'd really, I personally have not, I have never had the impulse to really idolize people, to, you know, have a role model, because it seems sort of like I don't need an externally imposed idea of what's good. Like, to me, true freedom, and it's like, I'm so conscious of, I'm 30, like I have been the beneficiary of so much freedom that other people and other women have carved out for me. And one of those freedoms that I have is I don't think there's anyone is served by identifying someone as sort of like an ideal. Like, why do we need ideal traits for women, you know? And I think that one thing that feminism has also done is now there's kind of a version of the ideal woman that's just like, you know, a woman that is super complicated and like takes a lot of shit. And there's sort of this idea that because women who do big things often are the recipient of huge amounts of sexism, that if you are the recipient of huge amount of sexism, it must mean that you're doing something interesting. And it's sort of like there's still an ideal woman, but that ideal woman is now just like very difficult and like a badass, like this whole idea. And yeah, I think that I used to work at a feminist website, and one thing that would bother me a lot is that we would report, like we would write about a woman, we'd criticize a successful woman, and we would get the response like, you shouldn't be tearing women down. You know, you should like let, you know, successful women, like we should support successful women. And I was like, guys, like real freedom is located in a world where, you know, we're not constantly designating women as ideal, you know, where it doesn't, you know, like we're not always thinking about men in these terms. Like I want that level of freedom where we don't have to just monitor the exact worth of a woman all the time. Like I want to not need to care.
And indeed, this is taken to its extreme when you look at, you know, there's these, I don't know, sort of like identikit blonde women that they have presenting Fox News or like, you know, Kellyanne Conway or Sarah Huckabee Sanders that you talk about in the book, women that have, you know, in no uncertain terms become incredibly successful, but obviously have incredibly pernicious politics.
Well, right. I mean, I think that, and part of what that essay is about is feminism has become this mainstream perspective over the last 10 years, and I'm so grateful for it and I've benefited from it. But in the process, like, I think there's something going on in the world right now that the internet exacerbates, where it's a lot easier to adjudicate inequality through cultural criticism, where it's like, so real sexism is composed of structural, right? It's I've been saying it's so funny talking about this book in the UK, where it's like, you know, let's take the US, where you have Sheryl Sandberg writing Lean In, you know, you have all of these, like, women are getting more power in culture, they're dominating cultural industries, and we don't have universal health care or paid maternity leave or paid parental leave. And it's like, that's where sexism matters. It's at the policy level. It's not about whether someone makes a joke about Sarah Huckabee Sanders' eyeshadow, you know? And so this idea that it's really, really important to identify that sexist criticism and identify and sort of deify and protect women against it as like a main political priority results in those things where, like, the news cycle in the States was swallowed by for a whole week after Michelle Wolf made a joke about Sarah Sanders' eyeshadow, and everyone's like, is it sexist? Like, how dare? Like, you know, can we talk about her face? And it's like, it doesn't matter. You know, like, sure, it's like, maybe that joke was sexist. It was definitely a joke about her looks.
Meanwhile, they're separating children from their parents.
Exactly. And it's also like, it just doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter. You know, there are just more important things. And it's like, this is one thing that feminism has become very successful at that I think has often been picked up by, in bad faith, by people, like, by right wingers in the States, where it's like, you know, it was the same where Melania Trump wore that jacket on the way to visit the border that said, you know, I don't really care, do you? And everyone was like, we shouldn't criticize a woman about her looks. And it was like, why are we, you know, it's such a distraction.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Gia Tolentino. We're talking about her debut collection of essays, Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion. And Gia, for the rest of the show, the second half of the show, I'm basically just going to talk about one essay.
It's a
bit of a cheat because it's the Seven Scams essay.
Oh,
which I think you could quite easily have made an entire book out of in itself. So you talk about the seven conditions or scams that, you know, millennials have basically grown up with, going from, you know, actual real scam artists like the Fyre Festival guy and Anna Delvey. Interestingly, I spoke to literally on the last show, Rachel Delos Williams, one of the people that was robbed by Anna. And all the way through the book, it's really difficult to, you have to keep reminding yourself that you're not supposed to be rooted for Anna.
Her. Her book. She actually, I think she's mad. She's mad that I mentioned Anna and she emailed me and she was mad about it, but it's fine.
And then you go on to talk about, you know, I want to talk about, first of all, the student debt, basically. And you talk about the sort of the financial crisis. And this is obviously a thing, the subprime mortgages and what have you, that obviously, like, you know, crippled an entire generation of people as well. Yeah. But often less talked about is the enormous levels of student debt that suddenly occurred over the last few years. And my wife has student debts, but I learned from your book, I wasn't aware that Obama had recently made student debt, like, it's
nationalized,
now been, like,
nationalized it, yeah.
Which somehow has made it worse?
Yeah.
How?
Well, okay, so this essay is about around the time that the Fyre Festival, you know, thing happened and the Anna Delvey story, there's just been this really, this essay came out of me feeling this energy whenever a scam story would come into the news. There was this really perverse attraction. America has always loved a scammer. Like, America is really built on a foundational, America is built on the idea that you just go into a place and you reinvent yourself and you can take whatever you want. So the scam is, like, so deep in America's DNA. And that's something that I've always found interesting. Like, any economic transition, like any banking transition in the 19th century would just be accompanied by just massive waves of scamming. Like, I've always found that interesting. But I had been thinking about this weird perverse attraction to scammers, which I in some ways shared. I think that from 2008 to 2016, the recession to the election, there were these seven things that rose to prominence that made scamming sort of a default ethos in the millennial generation. And I do think, right, like, we all know about the crisis. We all, like, it's obviously, like, it's so foundational. But I do, like, so for me, I was a senior in college and I was like, oh, so there's no accountability, you know, like, oh, so this is really, you know, you're so idealistic. Like, Obama had just been elected and you just realized that, oh, like, the people who did this are going to get huge bonuses, you know? And then there was all this footage of people just having to move out of their homes and whatever. And so, but yeah, I think that all of these scams are sort of escalating, right? They build on each other. As, like, so the home has always been such a traditional path to stability and upward mobility in America, right? It's like, you become a young adult, you put roots down, you amass equity, whatever. It's like your stability. All of these things are getting pared away. One of the things that it's hardest for people to understand is no longer an easy path, or not an easy path, but an accepted path to upward mobility, is the college education, right? Like, it's really hard for people to turn their backs on, for good reason. Like, for me, I got a full ride to college and it changed my life. Like, the educational institutions have, like, I jumped classes because of them. Like, they did the thing for me that they're supposed to do for everyone. And I think that because there's still this idea that, because for some people, education still does function as this incredible, life-changing thing, it is sort of, we've kind of been ignoring the fact that, you know, for example, I think student debt doubled between 2003 and 2018. The average debt burden went from $18,000 to $37,000, I think it is. And, you know, it is so parallel to the housing crisis where, you know, so many people ended up underwater for their mortgages. People are underwater because of their college. You know, they're on the hook for an education that's worth less than what they paid for it. And I think, but student debt is really interesting to me because it's a very clear instance where the college's need to compete in the market, it denies students the ability to do the same thing, right? Like, as colleges need to compete with each other to continually escalate their facilities and, you know, improve and optimize and all this stuff, they need to charge more in tuition. So they charge more in tuition and then their students can't compete in the marketplace after they graduate.
You talk about social media. Again, we've covered social media a little bit in the first half, and obviously the sort of optimization of data, you know, data gathering that's made Zuckerberg one of the richest people in the world. I want to talk about the ideas of the disrupting companies.
Oh, yeah.
When along with the rise of social media, so the likes of obviously Amazon, but also like Uber and an Airbnb, and their, you know, their interesting working practices for their employees.
Yeah, I mean, they operate on a model of minimizing liability to a degree that is basically openly inhumane. Yeah, so these industries, I think of them, they're also optimization industries in some way. Like, their business model is they monetize the effects of precarity and late capitalism, right? Like, Amazon has... It's entrenched itself as such a fixture because everyone has to work so much and everything is so expensive. Like, for example, if, you know, housing and health insurance are just soaring, if health insurance in America, right, it's like it's increased like 300%. Like, it's the costs are wild of all of these basic, you know, like education and health insurance. So, of course, you need to buy things $5 cheaper, you know, and get them delivered quickly. Like, it's sort of... Like, Amazon is successful because people are really at the end of a rope, you know, and it's warehouse workers for a long time. Right. They were like completely unprotected. They, you know, like famously, you know, the working conditions there, they can warehouse workers are peeing in bottles to avoid getting penalized or fired for taking too long of a toilet break. Like, right now, they're currently strapped to these monitoring devices. They're expected to pack like 90 things an hour. You know, it's just this notoriously openly inhumane system that people continue to use, and which I did for a long time because it is truly harder, you know, because life is harder. And it's the same with Uber and Lyft. It's like they have this convenient supply of people who need to monetize every spare hour to continue to make their rent or pay their mortgage or live. And it's as if they're acting as if that's a service when, you know, their drivers, you know, they don't give them health insurance. They, you know, are totally, they skim off. There was just a report this week about their official statistics about how much of the driver take they Lyft and Uber take. Like, they've been lying. It's actually 10-15% more, you know. And yeah, so there are all of these, and this idea that it's disruption, but, you know, what it is, it's sort of like breaking the economy apart and then selling you Band-Aids. Like, it's, and these companies are venerated as like the giants of this era.
Amazon and Uber are, you know, sort of Bond villain level evil companies.
Yeah.
But I think even more interesting is how Airbnb have done this, sort of transferred the responsibility from themselves onto their users in what seems like a more benign way,
I think it is more benign. I use Airbnb constantly, I'll say,
yeah,
you know.
I
use ride sharing services, and I used Amazon for a really, really long time. Airbnb, I think I included it in this chapter because, you know, it did share a similar model at the beginning. Like, this way of being that's been venerated is this extremely, you know, Silicon Valley, you know, male way of just like break all the rules and, you know, and get too big to have to answer for that. And they've all done it very successfully. In Airbnb, they were breaking, you know, their users were breaking local law and they never told them and it didn't matter. And they made the correct bet that at some point they would be too successful for cities to kick them out, and they mostly have been. And Airbnb, it's, you know, and again, like, this is something that I'm willingly, all of these systems, I'm willingly a part, I've made myself a willing part of them. But it's, I think so much of the world is structured around today, around consolidating advantage to people who already have it. And you know, and America is, of course, like structured around the idea that it's the opposite, but in effect, as you are more successful, the world works for you more. And with Airbnb, I think just the housing market, like how it is, even in New York, let's say, in New York City, it is allowing people to just drive up, like people who can afford to buy houses and run sort of illegal hotels and speculate to drive prices up, you know, to push people out of the neighborhoods they grew up in. You know, it's just this continual, all of this is like this continual escalation.
Just one more essay to finish us off then. I want to talk about briefly the essay Ecstasy. Mm. Which details basically your gradual losing of a fundamentalist religion and sort of replacing the transcendence you found in that with social drugs. And, you know, while I've never had religion myself, I've taken ecstasy enough times.
Yeah, it's great.
To understand where you're coming from here. I want to talk about that comparison briefly.
Yeah, so ecstasy is a very clear link between virtue and vice. And that's why I find it. I have a really ecstatic disposition, and I'm really grateful for that. It's like it is the thing that breaks through all of this thing that my brain is always doing, right? Like all of this analytical thinking. It's like you know, there's also a huge part of my body and my brain that wants completely unmediated sensory experience and wants sort of the absolution and unconsciousness of that feeling. And I've always wanted that, and I've always been drawn to it, and I've always been able to generate that feeling for myself. Certainly religion was a part of it, drugs are sometimes a part of it, but even just being alive, right? Like, it's like I would just feel struck by ecstasy often. And ecstasy, like, I mean, so one of the things, ecstasy is a thing you feel with religion, and it's a thing you feel with drugs. And it, with like 12th century mystics that were recording their visions of God, they're doing it in the same language as a 14-year-old on Reddit's like LSD forum talking about his first trip. Like, it's the same language. Like, when we see, when we are placed in that ecstatic state, it doesn't matter what causes it, the language is the same. And I have been so fascinated by that. And especially, you know, there's an immense personal resonance. You know, I'm not religious. I once was extremely. It was like the world that I grew up in Texas. And that feeling of kind of feeling sanctified, that's a feeling that I feel conflicted about, the fact that I've recreated it through different things, but also so lucky that I have been able to, because it's a good feeling. And I do think it's instructive in some ways. Like, I think that there is a kind of feeling you're able to access there that is meaningful, and that has influenced my way of thinking in like ways that I still don't understand, you know?
So I've been talking to Gia Tolentino. We've been talking about her debut collection of essays, Trick Mirror, Reflections on Self-Delusion, which is out in the UK from Fourth Estate. Gia, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.